Lunar Science. Welcome to Lunar Science, the series in which we discuss the scientific investigation of the Moon and its environment in the Artemis era. In this, episode 37, we return to the topic of lunar dust. The pioneer of lunar dust studies was Australian Brian O'Brien. Born in 1934, he died in 2020. Soon after, a conference to consider lunar dust opened with a tribute to Professor O'Brien. It was delivered by Ryan Watkins of the Planetary Science Institute.
We just wanted to put a quick mention out there just to kind of give a little memorial to Brian O'Brien, who was a fierce advocate for understanding and mitigating lunar dust and unfortunately passed away last week. He was a pioneer of the lunar dust detectors that were flown on many of the Apollo missions, and he was analyzing this data right up until the time of his passing. And there's just a nice little quote there that probably says something about Brian better than I really could. This was sent around in the Lunar L, just about his you know, background as both a scientist and explorer and the legacy that he left. And unfortunately, we had hoped that he could present at this meeting, and so we very much feel his absence today and thank him for all of the work that he did to understand dust.
O'Brien's findings were largely ignored for nearly 50 years by the lunar science community. This frustrates the surviving Apollo astronauts, such as Apollo 17 geologist astronaut Harrison Schmitt. By the way, the EMU he mentions is an extravehicular mobility unit, what you and I might call a spacesuit.
I remain very curious of why the idea of developing covers for the XEMU and other, shall we say, fabric-like materials that reject dust. Has this not been investigated? I thought there had been off and on significant investigation of rejecting dust off the EMU, and if you can do it off of that, you can reject it off of other things as well.
So are you, do you mean in terms of having sort of like dust rejection methods versus dust mitigation methods? This is actually something that I think will be good to talk about during the breakout session.
That's
is like, what is dust rejection versus dust mitigation and or dust heap out and exclusion versus dust mitigation?
It seems to me the most cost-effective way to deal with dust is not a whole bunch of mitigation methods. It's rejection. It's never bring it into the cabin. And never let it get into areas where it's going to be a problem. Why don't we invest our resources, limited as they are, in rejection rather than in all these different techniques for mitigation?
So say, yeah, you're preaching to Ron's.
Well, you know, yeah, and Ron's very familiar with the LRV, and basically it was a rejection system, and it worked extremely well, except for commanders that tend to break fenders off, and we repaired that. It didn't take much of an effort, really, frankly, to repair it, thanks to the team in Mission Control Terry Neal and
obviously right?
John Young was involved, but Terry Neal came up with the basic fix based on what we had in the cabin. But again, I remember being down at KSC probably a decade ago or more, where they were showing a solar array and other and radiator surface rejection techniques. What's happened to all that?
For some of those hard surfaces, and I think Michael mentioned this briefly, there is some work from folks still for the EDS, so like the electrodynamic dust shield, ways to remove dust from harder surfaces. I don't know if Michael wants to mention anything with that at all.
So that technology that you saw at KSC is called the electrodynamic dust shield. It's currently been, it's just come back. It's being tested on the International Space Station for space environments on the MISSI platform. There's also an opportunity to demonstrate this technology on a CLPS mission in the future. So that technology that you've seen is certainly going to be part of the larger dust mitigation, dust prevention strategy.
You may understand
my frustration because I, Cernan and I really did lose a lot of time trying to mitigate dust. And it would have been much better for exploration, for operations and everything else if surfaces and fabrics and everything rejected that dust. That should have been our emphasis for the last 50 years, but it hasn't been.
Yeah, in addition to the active techniques, there are folks who have been working on like surface coatings and things like that that are passive ways to make dust not stick to things. One of the questions Laurent Sabille asked in the chat is, were there observations about whether dust keeps accumulating on hardware on the surface, or does it only accumulate to a thin layer and then no additional layers? So like, does it adhere to itself? And I think the quick question to that is yes. But I don't know if Harrison, it says, or if.
Yeah, no, it keeps accumulating. There's no question about that. And it's one thing to be manipulating dust covers, and we did. But it would be much better if the dust just never accumulated. And I find it hard to believe that good engineering and good engineers can't come up with solutions fairly quickly on doing that. We obviously have had 50 years to work the problem, and it hasn't happened. So and I understand about funding constraints and things like that. But the XEMU briefing I had, it appeared that NASA was expecting to use Apollo techniques to get rid of dust off the XEMU. And I just find that very, very surprising.
I don't have an answer, but that's a great, we'll definitely have that in our report out. And I know that I'm sure you're talking with some other folks about it too. There was a question from Kirby Runyon, said, is there a role for water to remove dust from suits? Maybe picturing like a hose to spray everybody down. Or he says, spray inside the airlock, moist cloths, et cetera. I'm not as sure if folks are working on that. And then Jeff Gillis Davis had asked about using hard-sided suits instead of soft-sided suits for these kinds of things.
Right. So I'm a systems engineer for the PCS, the pressure garment system for XEMU. So to answer Dr. Schmidt's question, we have a system in place as the EPG, and that is an outer garment that is intended to go over the suit. And one of the intents is to have that be at the initial outer layer to help protect against lunar dust and regolith that may collect on the suit. So that's something that's a subsystem, so to speak, that's in development. It's part of the PGS system.
Will that be disposed of before entering the habitat or the cabin?
My understanding is that that's not meant to be disposed of, but I can double check that.
Well, then it's going to bring dust into the cabin.
Right. And so the approach that we've been looking at is trying to select materials that are going to be ideal to repel that lunar dust and prevent as much embedding of the particles into the textile or into the material as much as possible. And then we're hoping that along with cleaning activities that will help to mitigate the introduction of dust into HLS. That's the approach as it currently stands.
Well, of course, what I'm trying to get away from is any kind of cleaning activities. That is a waste of time.
That point is well taken, and I can definitely take that back to Amy.
Apollo 17 astronaut Harrison Schmitt and other lunar scientists in discussion in August of 2020. Ron Creel was a team member on the Apollo Lunar Roving Vehicle, and he confirmed Schmitt's view that lunar dust is a serious problem. In his words, dust everywhere.
Oh, very good. Yes, continue on with what Jack and others have talked about. I'm in good agreement with most everything. Here you see a picture of the only video we have. Charlie Duke took this video of John Young driving the rover. You see the dust being stirred up. This is what we call the Grand Prix, and that was going to be used to get mobility data due to some painting of some stripes on the side of the vehicle. I doubt that we'd ever gotten that accomplished. Dust everywhere. Dust was a considerable challenge and potential health hazard for previous short-duration Apollo missions. You've seen the video shown during the break of trying to clean with the dust brush, and I agree with Jack very definitely that dust brush, it does not work. We forced the crews and their design to spend valuable exploration time in futile housekeeping efforts. Earth tested, we did test with even with Apollo 12 soil, the cleaning method using the dust brush, and it worked here on Earth. It was not successful in the moon environment. And I do seriously question whether you can ever simulate the moon environment totally. Here you see the astronaut trying to clean dust from the radiators. And also, this is Apollo 15 plot there, showing that after the first time, Dave Scott said there wasn't any dust on the cover on the radiators after the first EVA, so he didn't do any dusting. Well, after the second EVA, he did dust off the radiators, and the solar absorptance went up by a factor of 5 or 6. I want to talk first about the static and mobile surface science equipment that was on the moon before, and then what you'll need to do for renewed Artemis missions. Disturbed dust, however, is disturbed by actions of the sun or by actions of astronauts or the landing devices, landing landers, is very much prevalent. I show here a picture, some pictures from surveyors showing a levitation of the dust. Also, sunrise can evidently elevate lunar dust, which has been shown. I've been told here that the laser ranging retroreflectors on 3 of the missions have shown a degradation over time. Unfortunately, all the instruments, the other active instruments, were turned off in September of 1977. So that's the end of our data. But there is some good data. And we did have the fact on Apollo 12 that one of the astronauts did run a finger swipe across the mirror showing how much dust had accumulated on the Surveyor 3 camera. Very accurate landing, by the way. Uncovered static and mobile radiators suffer dust coverage. Solar arrays will too. That's the Lunar Communication Relay Unit on the bottom left, and you can see how much dust was on it. The original plan was to have two different radiator covers, 35% and 65% coverage, and astronauts would adjust that. Well, that never worked out on the moon. Once we opened up those covers and got dust on there and couldn't remove it, then they always left the dust covers open and never had the 35% or 65%. It was always 100% open and still ran hot. The rover over there, you see, we also had a TV camera, had to be brushed quite frequently. Jack can tell you about that. As well as on Apollo 17, in the back area, we had a surface electrical properties instrument, which had a radiator, which got dust on it. It wasn't helped out by the fact that as on Apollo 16 and on Apollo 17, unfortunately, astronauts hit a hammer inside the lip of the fender extension and popped it off, which caused more and more dust to be generated. And then Jack could tell you about the dust repair that John Young worked on overnight to take some lunar surface maps and clamps and take them back outside the mirror module and fix the rover, which did help. I have encouraged people on rovers I've evaluated in different programs here recently that you need full coverage fenders on the wheels, which to help you out. This is all related to what we call Murphy's Law. Murphy's Law says that if something can happen, something bad can happen, it will. And that's what happened on those missions, Apollo 16 and 17, that we lost fender extensions. Not judging, but it's difficult to move around. I want to talk about potential solutions for the surface science equipment. I think you need to have remotely activated and retractable insulated dust covers for inclined solar arrays and or radiators. That assumes that separately sensors are protected with shields and with shutters and whatever you need. The inclination is very use can be useful to help assume that the dust would flow downward toward the surface. I'll show here two different kind of dust covers. The Russians did in fact put their Lunokhod rover on the moon before ours went up with the astronauts, and they had a motorized cover. Unfortunately, when they backed out of a steep crater, they deposited lunar regolith onto the radiator. And ultimately, the second Lunokhod, which that when that happened, it only lasted 4 months. The first one lasted 11 months. And I got to ask them, you know, wait, what happened? And they told me that story about how lunar regolith, lunar dust had caused them to fail. And we had on the rovers, we had a spring activated closure mechanism. And it only ever worked once on Apollo 15 when there wasn't dust on the radiator and it wasn't rushed. I've tried to point out there that I'd like to know more about the Chinese systems there. I do know that they used a nuclear heated system, but that's not going to be allowed. If you have the automated covers, you would reduce astronaut housekeeping time for crewed missions. And you certainly would need to have that for uncrewed missions. But it will introduce more survival and operational reliability issues. That's the bad news. The good news is you can contribute to nuclear nighttime, the lunar nighttime cold hibernation and survival during the very, very cold 14 and a half days. Let's move on now. I'm thankful that Joel already read out the quote from Gene Cernan, poor Gene with his picture that gets published around of him inside that lunar module with the dust all over it. And I'd like to just highlight the last sentence down there. You can be careful in cleaning up as you want to, but it just sort of inhabits every nook and cranny in the spacecraft and every pore in your skin. I've pulled out some other quotes here, which are interesting to me, that Pete Conrad said that he thought that an overgarment would be very useful. This would be a suit cover. This was not implemented. There just wasn't time to do any of this, to learn in real time about these improvements. Charlie Duke sent me a note last week that's quoted here in the middle that it verifies that they thought it was so bad when they got back inside the lunar module, they didn't take off their suits. When they got to the command module, Mattingly wouldn't let them come in until they floated a vacuum cleaner over and closed the hatch until they got cleaned up. And he believes strongly that an airlock would be mandatory for these longer missions with multiple EVAs. Also, Jack, quoting from his book, he essentially takes it beyond just being airlocks to being additional dust locks. The interior design of cabins must make for ease of cleaning or for automatic accumulation and elimination of the dust. What can we do? I strongly believe that the solution is to isolate the exploration crews from direct exposure to harmful lunar dust. This is to apply NASA's already developed isolation technologies for dust mitigation. I'm showing here a near-term solution and a far-term solution. In the near term, you can incorporate mud rooms and airlocks into your systems such that you leave the dust outside. And you also can incorporate dust covers, suit covers, to mitigate the dust. The far-term solution is the elegant Johnson Space Center Chariot rover, which I got to see back several years ago. And it actually was a highlight of the 2008 inaugural parade that actually would have suits that are left outside. That's a key thing, is to leave the suits outside in the environment if you can. I am encouraged here by a mention on the contractors that are developing the human landing system. One of them says he's gonna have two airlocks for moonwalks. And another one sent me a note that says the actual requirements that we've gotten from NASA and the approaches we're taking to meet them are almost entirely focused on minimizing the harmful effects of lunar dust on Artemis crew safe, health and safety. So I am encouraged that some people are at least aware of the problem and that we're working on it. the questions that I left here for y'all are, do you have any other suggestions for what can be done about dust? And the second question, would you travel to the moon if your good health could not be guaranteed? That's all I have.
Great. Thanks so much, Ron. There are several questions in the chat window or the Q&A window. I'll just ask one quick one for you real quick. Were fenders effective at reducing accumulation of dust on the LRV and astronauts? Do you think you have the same amount of dust without the fenders?
We tested actually in the KC-135 with a vacuum chamber with dust and a wheel inside there. And that's where people wanted to remove the fenders even before we got to go to the moon. But most definitely the fenders were very helpful. It's just that we had that bad luck, had Murphy riding with us. And on Apollo 16 and 17, the rear fender was lost. On Apollo 15, the left front fender was lost. We didn't find it out until we got back from the moon and looked at pictures. So that didn't cause nearly the problem that losing the right rear fender on the Apollo 16 and 17 did. So the fenders are very definitely needed.
Okay, great. So, well, thanks for that.
One of the unanswered questions is whether lunar dust can self-levitate, and if so, to what height? Again, Harrison Schmidt in discussion with colleagues.
A question about the retroreflectors. I'm unaware of any published information, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, that the retroreflectors have degraded. And I would not immediately assume if they have that was because of dust. This idea of dust levitation really is not supported by the observations that I made and others have made on the surface. Rock surfaces are not covered with dust, and you would expect them to be if you were getting levitation and motion in that levitation that would somehow degrade a retroreflector. So I think that's something you need to think very seriously about. And Laddie, of course, did not see any sign of dust levitation.
So we'll have Mihai Harani on in a little bit to talk a little bit about the Laddie observations. In respect to the retroreflectors, there's a really interesting paper I'm completely blanking on the first author right now, but he is at New Mexico, and so he uses the ranging from the laser ranging to look at the retroreflectors, and they do see a change in signal that I believe they looked at it in eclipse and not in eclipse, and they saw a difference in signal that they attributed due to thermal effects that were likely due to dust on the surface of the retroreflectors. So there have been changes over time. I'll try to find the reference for that and post it in the chat.
That may be how it's been interpreted, but that lunar environment is very hostile for a bunch of other reasons. And there may be other ways in which the shape of the retroreflectors, the shape of the cubes, can be distorted besides having dust come into them. If you come up with that reference, just email it to me. I'd like to see it.
Sure, will do. And there's been a lot of experimental work and also some modeling work. And I think Xu Wang just posted it in the chat that there's this recent Chang'e 3 rover observations of dust deposits on the sides of rocks and on the tops of rocks up to 28 centimeters in height. So they have some sort of like ground level observation. I think that the big question about dust levitation, and so I've studied this a decent amount. So one of the big questions about dust levitation is like the time scales over which it happens and under what sort of lighting and plasma conditions. And so we expect that and a lot of it's thought to happen a little bit more at the terminator regions where you have stronger and different electric fields, and why you might get really interesting conditions at the polar regions where the plasma conditions are a little bit different.
There's regolith debris on rocks. There's fillets. The rocks are being eroded by micrometeor impact as well as by solar particle spallation. But if you're getting levitation couple times a month, and it's moving, then you would expect to see that fine levitated dust accumulating on rock surfaces. And I'm unaware of any evidence that that is happen. Certainly observational evidence says it hasn't happened.
Yes, it's it's a challenging and an interesting open question, I think.
Well, it's not one thing as a geologist observing the surfaces of rocks and identifying minerals and other things on them, I would say there's no dust cover on those rocks, okay?
The question to be answered for the Artemis missions is, what don't we yet know about lunar dust? In August of 2021, Joelle Levine raised that issue. Now, Levine is research professor in applied science at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg in Virginia.
I'd like to talk about lunar dust and some knowledge gaps. This photograph from Apollo 11, which is Buzz Aldrin's boot print in the lunar soil, lunar dust, has become a very iconic photograph. Let me tell you about Neil Armstrong's comments as he was at the foot of the ladder on Apollo 11 on January 20th, 1969. And this is a quote, "I'm at the foot of the ladder. The lunar module foot pads are only depressed in the surface about 1 or 2 inches. Although the surface appears to be very, very fine grained, as you get close to it, it's almost like a powder down there. It's very, very fine. I'm going to step off the LM now. That's one small step for a man, one giant step for mankind. The surface is fine and powdery. I can say I can pick it up loosely with my toe. It does adhere in fine, it's like powdered charcoal, to the sole and sides of my boots. I can only go in a small fraction of an inch, maybe an eighth of an inch, but I can see the footprints of my boots and treads in the fine sandy particles." Little did astronaut Armstrong know that he made the first measurements of what turned out to be a very interesting phenomena on the surface of the moon that we had not really anticipated or planned. We've talked about meteorite impacts on the surface of the moon and how the surface layer and padded and fractured rock was formed by meteoric action. Let me talk about some lunar dust-related problems. One that hasn't been mentioned too much is vision obscuration. As Apollo 11, for example, was landing, the exhaust rocket on the lunar module blew up tremendous amount of dust into the lower atmosphere of the moon, causing some difficulty in seeing the surface. A second problem is false instrument readings, because dust resulted in overheating instruments. Number three, dust coating and contamination, loss of traction to both astronauts and lunar rovers, clogging of mechanisms, abrasion and erosion of things like spacesuits, thermal control problems, failures of seals, and inhalation and irritation to the astronauts. Let me give two quotes. This is Apollo 17 astronaut Gene Cernan. We've heard this before. "I think dust is probably one of the greatest inhibitors to a nominal operation on the moon. I think we can overcome other physiological or physical or mechanical problems due to dust. One of the most aggravating, restricting facets of lunar surface exploration is the dust and its adherence to everything, no matter what kind of material, whether it be skin, suit material, metal, no matter what it be, and its restrictive friction-like action to everything it gets on." That was from astronaut Cernan's debriefing. The problems, though, continued even after liftoff from the lunar surface. This is Apollo 12, astronaut Alan Beam. "After liftoff, a great quantity of dust floated free within the cabin. The dust made breathing without the helmet difficult, and enough particles were present in the cabin atmosphere to affect our vision." Now, this is in the cabin on the way back to Earth. "The use of a whisk broom prior to ingress would probably not be satisfactory in solving the dust problem, because the dust tends to brush deeper into the garment rather than to brush off." With these thoughts in mind, the NASA Engineering and Safety Center, which is an agency-wide program office located at the Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia, organized a conference on lunar dust and its impact on human exploration. What I want to do is I want to talk about the meeting and talk about the information generated. In fact, our chair, Professor Hotzel, attended the workshop and, in fact, was in panel one. Panel one was lunar dust, composition, structure, and distribution. Panel two, the impact of lunar dust on human health. And panel three, the impact of lunar dust on human surface systems and operations and techniques/technologies to reduce/mitigate these efforts. And NASA said they wanted two products of this meeting. The first is a NASA Engineering and Safety Center report that was released on September 24th, 2020, which summarized, it's about 60 pages, it summarized the discussions and conclusions. And then NASA also required a proceedings volume that was published earlier in this year by Cambridge Scholars in England. I have identified some of the key questions that came out of panel number one: particle size distribution, chemical composition, mechanisms cohesion, mechanisms controlling adhesion, thermal conductivity, magnetic properties, electrical charging, the effect of solar ultraviolet and solar wind, electrical charging of dust particles, electrical properties, and optical constants, impact of volatiles, permeability and packing, and other bulk properties. So there were 15 major areas that we have to work on: particle size distribution and movement of dust particles at all altitudes. Thank you very much.
In our next episode of Lunar Science, we will continue the topic of dust.